So here we are, we've come together as a community to share in the Dhamma and share in those things which are the heart and the core of what our practice and our life here is all about. And it's a somewhat sad, but it seems inevitable fact that when we're living the holy life and trying to run a monastery and so on, that we get distracted with other things. We have to build a monastery, we have to maintain it, we have to prepare the food for the day, we have to discuss and study kind of things like technical aspects of vinaya and legal procedures and work with different people in different ways and so on and so forth, all of which are somewhat peripheral to the real heart of why we came to Dhamma practice in the first place. So one of the things we learn from those things is that our Dhamma, our meditation, is somehow embedded in the world. And if it weren't for those external conditions, if it weren't for the fact that we live in a safe country that's at peace, if it weren't for the fact that we've been donated the land for the monastery, if it weren't for the fact that so many people were willing to support us in our practice here, if it weren't for the things that we've learnt from all our teachers of the past, whether our Dhamma teachers or just everybody who we've learnt from and have come to our understanding of Dhamma from, if it weren't for so many factors and so many things, that what we're doing here would be quite impossible. And in fact, as you know, it's a very rare thing and a very special thing. I don't know of any other place, certainly in the Sydney region, where you really find a group of the fourfold Sangha living together in a secluded forest environment like this and studying and practicing the Dhamma in this way. So of course there are many places studying and practicing the Dhamma, but the way that we're doing here I think is very special, not just in Sydney but also in many other places. Very, very hard to find, very rare. And so we should be incredibly grateful to have the facilities and the teachings and the opportunity that we have here. Practice with Sangha in residence and with a very diligent and sincere practicing Sangha and a very devoted and supportive lay community. And we can all do this together. So this is very important to remember. These things are not separate from our meditation practice. They're quite dependent on it. So we should never kind of divorce these things when we come to that time when we're sitting alone in our kuti with nothing to do but watch our breath coming in and out. We remember that the very fact that we can do this is dependent on so many others and so many acts of kindness and generosity and support and help. So on these Saturday night talks, I wanted to speak primarily focusing on the meditation practice and in particular explaining the metta meditation as was taught to me many years ago by Ajahn Mahachachai. So even though many of you have been around for a while and you've heard these teachings bit by bit, what I want to do for this rains retreat is to try to be a little bit more systematic and a bit more thorough and sort of go from one end of this practice through to, well, we'll see how far we get through to it, whether we go to all the end of it or not, I'm not sure. But anyway, we'll take it through quite a way. So perhaps first give a little bit of background for this practice. As many of you know, when I first came to Buddhism and first encountered the Dhamma was at Wat Ranpung, Mahasi Vipassana Center in Chiang Mai. And there I did some very intensive retreats, practicing the kind of the noting technique, watching the rise and fall of the belly and noting miscellaneous phenomena. And teaching there was, for me, very good because there was very little content in the actual teaching, but just a very a single-minded focus on doing the meditation with as much diligence as possible. And so in some ways, My experience there has set the tone for my entire subsequent life as a bhikkhu, both in terms of that meditation practice, but also in terms of after the retreat, when I first discovered the suttas and started reading them, and that's been the basis of my understanding of Dhamma since then. And so the meditation that I learnt there, I learnt a number of things which have been very fundamental for my practice since then. One of the things, of course, is like just seeing of impermanence and getting a sense of detachment from the stuff which is going on in your mind. And so this is something which that particular technique does very well. It gives you a very kind of disciplined, almost unrelenting sense of dissociation from thoughts and emotions and movements and anything which is happening in your mind and body, and you're kind of relentlessly and single-mindedly just kind of noting them and objectifying them and letting them go. And so one of the kind of the results of this practice is it leads to the emergence of various kinds of, if you like, states of consciousness, like changing of states of consciousness, which change over the period of a retreat. So at some periods you might, for example, you might like feel your mind is very spacious and very bright and very light, and other times then the mind might really change. It might become, for example, very tired. You can't even stay awake for a short period of time. Another time you might be filled with sort of strong emotional responses for no particular reason. Like one, you know, for one day you might feel just like a feeling of disgust. And so you go through a feeling of a day of just feeling complete, just like creepy. Everything's just sort of sticky and messy and disgusting. And then that kind of goes. So there's all these just different phases that the mind goes through. And through keeping a continuity of just meditating and just watching these things, and then you learn not to get engaged in them and not to worry about them too much, just to sort of sit back and just watch these things as they pass by. And you get a faith, that very strong faith, that simply through observing and through mindfulness, that so many problems can be will just solve themselves. And so these are some of the things that I learnt from this particular retreat, and you know, that way of practice has sort of influenced me ever since then, and still does influence me. After I left there, after some time I wandered around a bit, I ended up at Wat Nanachat and was practicing there, and I was still doing the same kind of practice there. Now, of course, Wat Nanachat, the main, various meditation systems are taught or allowed there. I mean, you can practice how you like, but the main one which is actually taught, of course, is breath meditation, Anapanasati. And so I was exposed to a somewhat different way of looking at things. And as you know, that Mahasi technique sort of stresses the difference between samatha and vipassana, and stresses that one should practice a kind of dry vipassana and just noting the kind of the bare phenomenon. And when I went to Wat Nanachat, I noticed that although they emphasized more the samatha side of the teaching, but also they didn't emphasize so much on the distinction or the difference between samatha and vipassana. And Ajahn Pasana summed it up once with a quote from Ajahn Chah, which I always remember, is that in samatha practice, you go along, you sit down, cross your legs, set your body erect, put your hands in your lap, watch your breath going in and out, and make your mind peaceful. Whereas vipassana is completely different. Vipassana, you sit down, cross your legs, set your body erect, fold your hands in your lap, watch your breath going in and out, make your mind peaceful, and then you know it's not a sure thing. So this is the difference between samatha and vipassana, is what I was taught at that Manachat. And one of the things that I noticed, or that I found, was that doing this Mahasi technique, was that I found it was very intense and very kind of emotionally demanding, and would cause like very strong physical reactions in my body at that time. And I found it a bit, it's different, you know, if you're thinking, right, I'm going to go in there and just push through this for a 10-day retreat or a 1-month retreat or something, it's different than if you're thinking, well, I'm going to be doing this every day of my life for the rest of my life. And then you have a different relationship with your meditation. So I sort of started to get interested in doing some kind of meditation that I'd actually enjoy. And, of course, this was not part of the agenda at Wat Rampung. It was like, watch out, you know. So I tried various things. I tried doing asubha meditation and body contemplation and so on. I had, you know, that was okay. It was worth doing, but I never felt like a really strong connection with that kind of meditation. And I tried doing breath meditation, and that also was quite good, but I found that, especially in the early days doing that, that it was pretty much hit and miss, and that a lot of the time I might end up at the end of an hour's meditation and just thinking, well, what was that? You know, it felt like nothing, it was just a bit of a waste of time, really. It was just, I wasn't able to really connect with the breath and work with it. And at that time, so that was in 93, 94, and at that time, Ajahn Brahm's teachings on meditation were just starting to become more well known in our community. So within a couple of years after that, his teachings were very well known. But at that time, they still weren't so well known. And so this whole idea of like finding bliss in the breath and finding pleasure in the breath and working with the beautiful breath, these were ideas which were not so current in the community at that time. So when I was at, I did a retreat at Dao Dham as an Anagarika. And one of the things that I would do as a practice there every day was just chant the Metta Sutta in English in the evening. And I found that when I was doing that and just doing the chanting and recollecting the Metta Sutta and the meaning of it, that, you know, I just feel this sense of joy sometimes. I remember, you know, just some evenings, just this sort of inexplicable sense of joy and happiness came up. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. You know, I didn't know that. You know, I always thought that these things were something that somebody else would have, you know. Somebody else maybe feel kind of joyous and light and they have kind of this kind of spiritual bliss. But I never thought that it would be me who would feel those kinds of things. And so I was quite attached to it, I guess. And so I used to do that every evening. And so then I sort of, from there, I sort of started trying to experiment with doing metta meditation. But I didn't know anybody who really taught it very well. And when the senior monks would come through Wat Nanachat, various ajahns from England and so on, and I always take the time to go and see them and ask them questions. And so this is something I always made a point of as a young monk. It was whenever we had visiting elder monks in the community to always find the time to go and see them and ask them questions about meditation and Dhamma. And but I found that they actually couldn't really answer my questions about meditation. And they didn't really seem to have much of an idea how to do metta meditation either. And so I was very lucky. I spoke about this with a visiting monk when he came, Ajahn Tignano. He's a tall, thin French monk. And very tall, very thin, very French. And it was the only time I actually met him, but we had some very lovely chats about meditation, metta meditation. And as it happened, he had just spent time in Bangkok visiting a monk called Prajan Mahachatchai. And Ajahn Mahachatchai, he had found Ajahn Mahachatchai through an article in the Lok Tip magazine. It's like this monk's magazine. Lok Tip means literally divine world. And it's usually got kind of amulets and monks with psychic powers and all of these kinds of things, but it occasionally has a little bit of Dhamma in there. And so Ajahn Mahachatchai had got himself an article in there, so they'd heard about him and gone to interview him and so on. And I think it was the same, maybe it was the same article that he saw that also Young Vera saw. Ajahn Mahachatchai's main lay supporter is a fellow called Vera, who's he and his wife Chumsi were looking for a meditation teacher in Bangkok, and they'd kind of exhausted all of the possibilities, and they just didn't know where to find, and they sort of travelled around and they found that all of the decent teachers were so busy and had so many students that they couldn't spend time with them, and they literally put this into perspective. They're living in Bangkok. There's like 10 million Buddhists in Bangkok. And I don't know how many thousands, tens of thousands of monks. There's probably 100,000 monks in Bangkok. And they couldn't find a decent meditation teacher. And so he was about to sort of give up in despair. And then he sort of sat meditation on his bed and really made a determination that he wanted to find his teacher to learn meditation. And when he came out of meditation, he noticed this monk's magazine, the Lok Tip, was just lying around the room or something. And it happened to be open on a page, and he looked at that, and he hadn't noticed it before, and there was Ajahn Mahachachai there. So he went to see him, and he's become a very dedicated follower. And he said in his dedication, one of his books, that all he wants to do is to follow Ajahn Mahachachai, not just in this life, but also in any future lives as well. And so then Ajahn Titinyana sort of told me some of the basics of Ajahn Mahachachai's approach to metta meditation, and so I took them on board and started trying to practice them. But I had a lot of misunderstandings and misconceptions at that time. And I was still a novice at that time. And it took me quite a while to actually figure out how the system worked and how I should actually be practicing. And after that, Ajahn Titinyana would go back to Bangkok, and I would write him long letters with all of these very silly meditation questions. And then he would go to Ajahn Mahachachai and get all the answers and dig out huge amounts of information and spend a long time translating them and writing them and sending them back to me. So these letters are still in existence, and one day we always had the plan to make a book out of them at one stage. So Ajahn Mahachachai is a very humble, very kind of ordinary monk in many ways. He lives in a small, unknown and undistinguished monastery in the middle of Bangkok. The monastery is called Wat Pleng Bang Plat. If you tell anybody you're going to Wat Pleng, they'll always think it's Wat Pleng Vipassana, which is a bigger monastery not far away. And Wat Pleng Vipassana, there was actually where a lot of the early Western monks ordained and stayed in the early days. But Wat Pleng Bang Plat is actually almost completely unknown. Ajahn Mahachachai is not the abbot there, he's the vice abbot. But he's about the only one there who seems to be really interested in meditation. I guess there's, I don't know how many, maybe a dozen monks or something in the monastery. And then with the support of Veera and the other meditation supporters, they've built a medium size, not particularly large meditation hall, but nicely done with aircon and so on. So they come there. Usually they come to the meditation hall at least once a week on a Sunday and do a session where they'll sit around with a smallish group, as maybe 20 or 30, something like that. And they'll sit around with Prajan and do some chanting. They do quite long chanting. He's very into doing chanting with the lay people and doing sitting meditation there. So Ajahn Mahachachai himself was born in Udon Thani in northeastern Thailand, but he ordained as a monk and practiced in Bangkok. And even though he sort of was in the Bangkok academic circles, he always had an interest in meditation and a great respect for the forest ajans. And he seemed to be just one of these people who had a natural affinity with meditation. And then just sort of naturally just had very good samadhi. So he's one of the few monks who actually has a good pariyatti as well as a good samadhi. So, you know, he's sort of very familiar with Pali terminology and these kinds of things. So, and this is one way that sort of made it easier for me to sort of connect with him and ask him questions and get more. He's got a more systematic approach than the forest monks tend to have. He sort of lays out his whole kind of system, which gives a sort of a much more clarity about how the practice should go. And he's also just a very lovely monk to be with, very very quiet, very very humble, he's very dignified and he's got a very strong sense of restraint when he's walking out on Pindabhata and these kinds of things. He's always extremely mindful. When he's walking around, he told me once that when he's walking around on Pindabhata that he just counts his breath constantly from when he leaves the monastery until when he gets back. And so he doesn't miss a breath in the whole time he's out on Pindabhata. He goes for a very long Pindabhata, usually about 2 hours, and counts his breath constantly for the whole time. And he said he's just like he's floating around on Pindabhata. He just floats around on a cloud and then comes back again. And so he lives there quietly at that monastery, doesn't get involved in too many things, and just teaches his little bit of meditation and does his practice. And he's one monk, you know, you can really ask him questions and really probe him for questions, and he'll give very penetrative and very useful answers to almost any kind of Dhamma question you can give. And that's not just my opinion, but also the opinion of Ajahn Chitnyano. And Ajahn Chitnyano is renowned in the Western Sangha for being, of all the monks, he's the one who went round and interrogated every monk he could possibly find everywhere about everything. And he would just grill them and suck information out of them that nobody else could get. And he just sort of chewed through all of the Ajahns in the Thai tradition, one after the other, trying to suck as much information as possible out of them. And then he moved on to Sri Lanka, and then he went to some Mahayana places in Singapore and Malaysia and so on. And I think he was even in Indonesia at one time trying to chase down some obscure yogis there. And then he was in Myanmar, Pa Ok Monastery, and interrogated the Sayagatdor there, and at various other places in Myanmar as well. And at the end of that whole kind of thing, he said that he had his best meditation doing Ajahn Mahachacharya's practice, and felt that he was the, of all the monks he met, was, he also was with Ajahn Chah, but he said of all the monks he met, he was perhaps the best monk at actually answering and giving satisfactory answers to any kind of Dhamma question. So after some time of exchanging these letters, you with Ajahn Chitnyano as the medium, I got the chance to go to Bangkok and visit Ajahn Mahachacharya personally. And he speaks some English. He's actually got a reasonable vocabulary, but not very confident in speaking. But his supporters, Weera and Chumsi, speak quite good English, so they would translate, and I would try my little bit of Thai to work out what was going on. And so I usually would go down there once or twice a year, either by myself or with one or two other Western monks who would go down there and stay there for a couple of days and have some discussion, some teachings with Prajan. And this has more or less continued up until now. And last time I saw him, of course, was in February when I went to India. So that's just a little bit of background about where this practice has come from, and you know, what we're doing here when we're learning this particular practice. Now, as I mentioned before, that I had been interested in doing metta practice, but hadn't found any really clear and useful guidelines for how to do it. And this was, I found, and I still believe, is the best and most systematic and most powerful method for doing metta meditation. And I believe also that when the notes and so on were shown to Bhikkhu Bodhi, he also had the same opinion, that it was the best and clearest system for doing metta meditation that he'd ever seen. So, you know, one of the things that I found when doing this practice was the most immediate response from doing the practice was simply the ability to feel a lot of happiness and a lot of joy, and to be able to call that up almost whenever or wherever you wanted. I mean, it may be a bit difficult if you're in a time where you're very stressed or very tired or something like that, in which case it's best to avoid trying to do the practice in those times, and try to keep a positive association so you only do the practice when you're feeling good, or at least reasonable. But, you know, when you learn how to use that perception and how to trigger it, then you get quite confident that you can actually bring up this feeling of happiness and bliss whenever you want to. You get quite, becomes quite dependable, quite trustworthy, which is something that's very beautiful. So this is one of the things that kind of persuaded me to stick with this particular practice over the years. And one time I asked Ajahn Prajan, I said, you know, he said, listen, you should, you know, do like this, like this, like this, and practice. He's very specific in how he tells you to do it, and he doesn't give the same instructions to everyone. But I said, how long should I practice like that? He said, just for the rest of your life. I said, fine, okay, I'll try that then. So let's start. One of the characteristics of Ajahn Mahachacharya's approach is that he emphasizes doing a period of, if you like, bare awareness practice before starting the actual metta. And he recommends doing this for 5 to 10 minutes or so before each sitting. But he also recommends doing it before starting the metta practice at all, so before actually trying to do metta, to spend at least a day or a few days or a week or so not doing metta at all, but just doing basically equanimity and an equanimous bare awareness practice. So that's what I'm going to talk about for today. I won't talk about metta, and we'll just talk about this practice. Now, this is something Ajahn Chachai calls, he uses the Thai word Jipen Glang, which means, literally means the mind in the middle. And the other word he uses for it is Du Arom, which means to look at moods. The word Arom in Thai, more kind of Thai characteristic of it is to look at, is mood. But in Pali, it has the meaning, Arom also has the meaning of any, Aramana has the meaning of any object of the mind. And in the way Ajahn Hachachai teaches it, it kind of has a bit of a both flavors, but he certainly does say it means literally anything knowable, so just looking at the objects, looking at the object of the mind. So this particular kind of practice is very similar to, say, Mahasi technique. It involves noting. It's also similar to, like, Goenka practice of, like, doing body sweeping, similar to say, I think the Dzogchen practice or the Zen kind of just sitting kind of thing. Or it's also similar to Ajahn Brahm's kind of silent awareness practice, or again to Ajahn Sumedho's like the sound of silence kind of thing. So all of these things are similar. And we actually asked Ajahn Mahachachai about this one time when I was there with Ajahn Chandiko. And he explained this particular practice which he does, which is similar to like a Goenka body sweeping practice. And he said, you know, is it okay to do this? And he said, yeah, that's just the same as Jipen Glang. So any of these kind of practices can be used in this way, okay? So if you're used to using one of these kinds of things, a Hasi technique or Goenka or whatever, then, you know, just you can just keep on doing that if you want to. You don't have to change it, but I'll just explain the way that Ajahn Hachachai himself teaches it. If you want to do it in that way, that's fine. If you want to just keep doing it the way that you're used to, is also fine. There's no need to change that, but just doing the metta practice later on will supplement that. And so the way Ajahn Mahachachai teaches the Jipen Glang is that you don't have a particular object of meditation. So unlike Mahasi technique, where you take the rise and fall of the belly as your basic object, and then sort of note things that drag you away from that, then in the Jipen Glang practice, you don't have any kind of basic object, okay? So the basic practice is simply to sit there and be aware. If you want to, if that's too kind of abstract or too difficult to do, especially at the beginning, then you can ground that by focusing, especially in the beginning, on the body sensations. And so again, a little bit like Goenka technique of just scanning the mind through the different bodily sensations and noting that it's just the different feelings that you're feeling in different places. And so, you know, much of the body is kind of neutral. You don't have much feeling there. So you can just be aware of that. Or some places there may be some pain or stress, and then you can be aware of that. Sometimes maybe some cool or warm sensation, and you can be aware of that. And so just to ground yourself in the body a little bit and move the mind around gently, but just directing it to the different places. When you're doing this, don't get too caught up or obsessed with particular painful feelings or tensions in the body, okay? And sometimes there's a tendency of the mind to get sucked towards these things. And becomes like an obsession, and they kind of worry it, you kind of nag it, you kind of go in there and nag these painful feelings. So don't do that, there's no need. So just, you know, again, if you have painful or stressful feelings, then just to be aware of them and then just leave them behind and move on. Don't allow them to kind of attract the mind or worry the mind, and just look at all these the different feelings. So of course, especially in the beginning, we should be just trying very gently to relax. You know, so if you feel this kind of tension, you can just sort of just relax the tension and just move the tension out and so on. But again, not to be worried too much about it. If there's some of the tension that doesn't unlock,
Don't worry about it. You just, in this moment, it's just the trivial stuff, really. That's like an initial relaxation. The deeper kinds of tension will unlock as the samadhi gets deeper. So you don't need to try to solve all the problems at this stage. But it's useful to move around and get some kind of idea of what the body is from the inside, how the body feels like, what the experience of the body is from the inside. Yeah? And, you know, placing the mind deliberately in places where you normally wouldn't do that. Like, what does it feel right now in the middle of my left thigh? You know, sort of placing the mind in the middle of the body like that. What does that feel like? And try to sort of sense out what's going on. Even if nothing's going on, then you know that. And so moving around and getting that grounded on that awareness in the body. Now, while you're doing that, of course, what tends to happen is stuff comes up. Usually thoughts come up, and perceptions and memories and images and all of these kinds of things all arise in the mind. And so when those happen, then we simply just use the noting technique. So whatever comes up, we just note it, thinking, 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 seeing, seeing, seeing. If there's an image, you say image, 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 or whatever it is, memory, 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 whatever it may be. Don't worry too much about what the labels are, okay? You're not trying to get the, there's no kind of right labels and wrong labels, okay? You can say frog, frog, frog if you like. And, in fact, sometimes it's quite good to do silly things like that because it sort of cuts the mind, stops it from being too serious. But it's just a way of drawing attention to these things. One thing that's important whenever you're noting, and this applies in whatever technique you use, this is don't try to use your noting to make things go away. Okay, so noting is a technique which is supposed to bring your attention to things. Okay, it's to help you to know it, to bring your mind to it, your mindfulness to it, and to sort of pin your awareness on it clearly. This is the purpose of noting. It's not to try to make things go away. Of course, when you do that, what often happens is that things do go away because things are very insubstantial. Thoughts and memories and so on are very insubstantial. And when you bring the attention to them, what you're doing is you're cutting off the roots that gave rise to those thoughts and so on. And you're looking at the, by looking at the outcome, looking at the actual arisen thought, you're not focusing on the emotion or the whatever that caused the thought to arise in the first place. So often by doing that, then the thought just disappears, and that's fine. But you remember that you're not doing it in order to make it disappear. Often thoughts and so on are very transient. Other things are much less so. So, for example, emotions tend to last for much longer. You don't just kind of, you know, if you feel a feeling, you know, a feeling of tension or a feeling of jealousy or a feeling of anger or a feeling of confusion or whatever, and you can locate that in your body, and it's more generalized, it's not so specific. And when you note these things, they usually don't go away straight away, they usually have their own momentum and will take some time. And you know, if you like, you can think about them in terms of also chemical reactions or the actual physiology of it, like a thought is primarily like an electrical transference in the brain. So it's actually an electrical phenomenon which, you know, the physical aspect of it is an electrical phenomenon which, you know, when you pull the plug on the electricity, it disappears straight away. Whereas emotions are more kind of sort of stewed up in a chemical soup. And that, you know, if you actually look at different emotional responses, will cause different sort of chemical reactions in the body. And so these take time. To the chemicals take time, like adrenaline or endorphins and these kinds of things, to actually be processed and to shift and to change. So physiologically, you can't expect these things to just disappear straight away. And you know, you shouldn't want to. It's just it's a practice in awareness, not a practice in getting rid of things, but just to know them. And so when you do this at the start of the practice, one of the things you're doing is you're just kind of checking in with how you are. Okay, this is one of the purposes of this. You're saying, how am I now? How am I actually feeling? And you're giving yourself a chance to breathe for a while, just relax for a while. How's it going? Yeah? And just to sort of suss that out and have a bit of compassion for that. a bit of empathy for, oh, okay, this is how I'm feeling, and you know, these have been going on, I've had these issues or whatever. And then you feel those things, or maybe you don't feel them, maybe you just feel very light and positive and happy and you feel great, so you can rejoice in that. So this is just to check in on what's going on. So this is one of the purposes of doing this Jitben Glang practice. Another purpose of doing the Jitben Glang practice is just to gain a measure of stillness and emptiness in the mind. Okay? Not a deep level of emptiness and stillness, but some level of space in the mind. And one of the best ways of doing this is to focus on the gap that happens in between the thoughts. And so when you're thinking along about, oh, then you realize that you go thinking, and then there's a space. Yeah, so pay attention in that silence and in the space. And this is what Ajahn Mahachachai said, that space is the Jitben Glang, that's where the mind in the middle actually lives, is in that space where the thoughts are not happening anymore. Okay? And so by doing that, you get like, it's almost like you get this, even if you may have thoughts that are still coming and going, but you get this perception that the thoughts aren't just filling your mind anymore. So you're shifting your perception that rather than your mind being just thoughts and just a series of thoughts and content, that you realize that actually those thoughts and that content are given structure and meaning because of the space around them. Okay? Normally we ignore the space. Okay? So this is some of the purposes of the Jitben Glang. Another purpose of it for the first purpose I said, just to check out how you're going, like where you're coming from, to get a sense of space and quiet in the mind, but also a little bit more specifically, is that you want to be able to let go, to be able to see and understand and let go of any moods and emotions, especially those which are on the side of dosa or aversion, okay? So any kind of sense of annoyance or jealousy or anger or irritation or whatever, anything in that kind of spectrum of emotional responses you want to be very clear about, because of course that's the direct opposite to the metta meditation. So you want to be very clear about those things and be able to know them very clearly and to hopefully let go of them. So this is the glangness, the middleness of it all, is that you want to try to get to a place where you feel equanimous. And so that means letting go of those moods of irritation and aversion. The other thing that you have to let go of, and this is sometimes even trickier, is you also have to let go of joy and happiness. Okay? So joy and happiness, it does not belong in this meditation at this time. This is a meditation on equanimity. Okay? And so when you feel the joy and happiness coming up, as it will do sometimes in this practice, again, you should note that happiness, joy, and let go of it and come back to a neutral feeling. It's very, very tempting. If you're doing this practice, you feel maybe some joy spontaneously comes up and you think, right, I'll ride on this wave of joy and let that ride me into my metta practice. Okay? And that's the wrong way to do it. Okay? What that is doing is that then you're having like an unreflective relationship with your joy and your happiness, where you're actually getting caught up in it. And the problem with that is that later on in your meditation, you will also try to ride with that or try to push it. You won't learn to get that sense of equanimity towards the joyful feeling, okay, towards the blissful feeling. Yeah? And that will become very important later on in developing your samadhi. Okay, it's not at the beginning, it doesn't matter. You don't see what the problem is. You just, it's just joy and you feel the happiness and you go with it and that's great. No problem. But when the mind gets very subtle and the mind starts to want to come together in samadhi, then that sort of sense of getting intoxicated with the joyful or pleasant feeling, that will be a great obstacle and that will stop the mind from settling down into samadhi. So here we're training the mind, even at this very preliminary stage, we're training the mind in the skills that it needs to be able to get deeper samadhi. So some of those skills are the skills in being able to understand and know, let go of the physical sensations in the body, to understand and know, let go of thoughts, okay? And also to understand and let go and not react to the feelings and the feelings of bliss and pleasure in meditation, okay? So if you have feelings of rapture or joy that arise in this initial stage, just note them as well, let them go, bring the mind back to equanimous feeling. Okay? And so you want to get to a place where you have like a stable and clear awareness. It's actually this practice of the, I guess if you canonically, if you looked at what this practice is like, it would be like a sampajanya practice. It's really what you're developing here. Sampajanya is like this contextual, clear awareness and understanding. So you really, and then you get to a stage where you think, okay, that's right, here I am. And you can check, you can review, okay, I've got, that's enough, reasonable degree of equanimity, in a reasonable degree of quiet, my mind's settled down from that initial buzz, and the feeling is neither not very painful or very pleasant. Doesn't have to be totally completely neutral, but just generally speaking, fairly neutral kind of feeling. And then you make quite a deliberate or conscious effort to go into the metta and to call up the pleasant feeling of metta, so that the going into metta should come from that kind of basis. The ground's being prepared in that kind of way. Okay? So, in just a moment, we can do some guided meditation during this practice. But just before we do that, I just want to ask if there's any questions, especially any practical questions that people have about that practice before we do some.
So the initial invitation is to sit and allow body sensations to arise as they do, without going into any particular part of the body.
Yeah.
Unless the mind feels like it needs the stability of a form, like sweeping.
Yeah. Okay. If you can just sit and watch, like Zazen practice, then that's fine. That's probably the best way to do it. But also another thing actually with this practice is not to go too deep into anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he actually said the word don't peng. Like to peng is like to stare at things. So he said, don't stare at things, just know them. So you're not doing at this stage like a really deep investigation where, you know, sometimes of course that is appropriate. You know, you maybe have a particular feeling, you might be in your body, and you really want to focus that and go into that and go deeper and deeper and deeper. So this time we're not doing that. It's more shallow, yeah? And we're just keeping it a bit light. You know, we're not trying to go really deep.
So let's do some Jipen Glang practice, equanimous awareness practice for the next half an hour or so. When you come to sit meditation, then you should always make your intention very clear. And it's useful to help that by starting out by bowing at the shrine and maybe doing a short puja, a little bit of chanting, and then sitting down. When you sit the first moments or the first period of time, make sure that you're sitting properly. With the back straight, shoulders a little bit back, head a little bit down. Make sure that your cushion is high enough. Don't get into a bad posture and uncomfortable sitting just because your cushion isn't high enough. Remind yourself that this is not the time to worry about the past. This is not the time to worry about the future. This is the time to worry about present moment exclusively. Focusing attention inside the body. Sweeping the mind gently around different parts of the body. Exploring, wandering, noticing what you find along the way. Anything which is distinctive that comes up, then just use noting to note that. Beginning of cold, you just say cold, cold, cold. Tension, you can just say tension, tension, tension. It's a way of exercising the mind, not letting the mind be too lazy. When the mind starts popping up with thoughts and so on, then just thinking, thinking, thinking. As often as it takes, thinking, thinking, thinking. Noticing all the gaps, the places where there's no feeling inside the body, spaces inside the mind where there's no thought. And the spaces where there's no sound. noting the mood, the emotional tone or texture that is carrying on into the meditation. Usually you'll feel this embodied somewhere, often in the belly, maybe the heart, sometimes in the shoulders or neck, maybe in the face, can be anywhere. See how this kind of emotion feels. And embrace that, be aware of it, bring full awareness to it. Also just allowing it to just to be on its own, not expecting it to come or go. Just to be having a sense of distance from the motion so that you can watch it clearly without getting caught up in it, not allowing yourself to spin off in a train of thought that's triggered by the emotion. We're just watching it compassionately from a slight distance. As the mind gets familiar with the various features of the landscape, then rather than moving it around looking for sensations and so on, and just allow it to come back a bit more and settle into the heart and just watch. Till we can feel the mind cool and aware. Reflective. Poised. So now we're coming near the end of the meditation. Just take a couple of deep breaths to wake the body up again. And before doing anything, just take a minute to reflect over what just happened. Looking at how you started out the meditation. How it might feel like. What was your attitude? How were you inclining or focusing on the meditation? And how did the meditation proceed? How much clarity was there? How much distraction? How much were you able to be aware of what was going on? And then, what does the mind feel like now? How are you? Is your mind feeling clear, or is it feeling tired or sleepy, or what kind of feeling do you have in it now? Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy, may all beings be well, may all beings rejoice in the merit that we've made through our practice. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu. And you can open your eyes and mindfully come out of meditation. So anyone have any comments or questions before we finish this evening?
That was great, thank you. Is there a picture of
Nagarjuna? Yeah, there are some around. I used to have one. I haven't had it for many years. It kind of disappeared in one of my Tudong purges. I'm sure we can get one. No. This is Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Chah. Yeah, not yeah, another. This is Ajahn Chai, not Ajahn Chai, not Ajahn Chah.
Thanks for the food.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah, much better.
It's very Zen.
It's really interesting because the way IMS teaches is actually to do metta first as a way to calm the mind and then to switch to vipassana. You know, even just a sitting, so you start with 10 or 15 minutes metta and then you switch to mindfulness. And this is another way around.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure both of them have the same basic aim, which is to, there's kind of a balance of those, the different qualities. And sort of calling up different aspects. So if there's no more questions, change my band aspects.
Bhagavato sabbaka sangho sangha.